Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Wildfowl podcast. I'm Skip Knowles, editor of Wildfowl, and I'm about to live a dream come true here. I can't believe what we're doing. We're in Alberta recording this one, and it's not September. It's not October. It's not the start of the migration. It is almost mid-May, and we're up here to intercept the last of the snow goose migration, something I've always dreamed of doing ever since I heard about people hunting snow geese well into May in Saskatchewan. And it's been on the bucket list for me ever since, and here we are doing it. I've got a chance to talk to you about that today with a young man named Jordan Maul, who I met years ago hunting with Mojo Outdoors and TV. And he's someone I hunted with in September this past fall. Had absolutely lights out hunts for, I don't know, specks, graders, lessers, and Ross geese, snow geese. We shot so many different kinds of geese and quick limits with him. He's the real deal. And I knew he was a big fall hunter and a great big game hunter from my home state of Colorado. He grew up in Minnesota, Jordan Maul. He's from Hidden Prairie Outfitters. But I did not know he's hunting snow geese way past turkey season most places, or is Jared Chestnut here too with Mojo Outdoors. He's our talented videographer and cameraman. He was just complaining that the crappie spawn is winding down back home. Crappie spawn, and here we are up here to shoot geese. It's just too cool to be true. And we're also going to talk about testing a prototype of a new Mojo motion decoy that is just a prototype. We can't be too specific, but we're going to talk about it. And well, for right now, we have Terry Demon on the line, the one and only Terry Demon, the mastermind behind Mojo. And we're going to talk to him about what is going into the development of that motion decoy that we have gotten to test a little bit out already on this trip. How are you doing there in Louisiana, Mr. Terry?
I am doing great. I'm not doing as good as y'all are because I'm down here working in the deep south, and y'all up there hunting snow geese, so I'm not doing as good as you are. But I appreciate you calling me the one and only. But, you know, I don't know what happened to him. By the way, you used to could Google that, and there was some guy on death row in Alabama named Terry Denman. So I don't know if he's still on death row or not, but I appreciate you saying that.
Well, your number one camera guy here, Jared, he suggested I use Evil Mastermind, but I do resent that statement. I'm working very hard. I mean, I'd be out scouting geese. Like, Jordan, how long has it been since you scouted us some geese?
I got back at about 11 a.m.
About 30 minutes, so. So, well, real quick, what did you see anything?
Yeah. So we're going to be hunting a field tonight that, you know, I've seen them in there the last morning. We saw them in there last night. And then this morning they were back in there. And with snow geese, the more pattern you can get on them, the better success you're going to have. So, you know, getting that field that they're returning to in the morning and night, and, you know, for a few days, it's the, you know, that's the perfect formula for a good hunt.
Jordan loves it up here this time of year. Because you can see geese in a field that he has possession of or rights to hunt, and leave them alone for two or three or four days and let them really settle in and normalize, which is not something you have the luxury of in a hyper-competitive world of mainstream snow goose hunting in March and February and or in the fall, heaven forbid. But well, I'm going to touch on real quickly why this can be like the supreme thing in snow goose hunting, and then let Jordan talk about how he described it to me. I absolutely had to come no matter what, but I knew it's the end stage of the migration. The geese have the leisure from Louisiana up to the mid province, you know, of Alberta and Saskatchewan. They can choose what farm field they want to go to today. There's all kinds of grain fields, you know, endlessly in sight, all from the American Midwest, Mississippi Flyway, from Monroe, Louisiana, where Terry Demon sent right now, all the way up here to where we're hunting in central Alberta. They could stop whenever they want, jump fields whenever they want, leave whenever they want. It's part of what makes them so hard to pin down and hunt. But up here, it's the last stage of the grain and farm country. Biologists call it jumping the trees, hopping the trees, leaping the boreal, talking about the boreal forest that goes for thousands of miles from here to the Arctic tundra and their breeding grounds. It's their last chance to really feed up, get strong. The geese know it. They loiter because there is very little pressure up here this time of year. So that's two reasons, major reasons why it's so good. And Jordan's going to tell us a little bit about what we're seeing in terms of the geese just acting differently, flying more like honkers, not big spins. We like flocks of 5 to 20 to come in for the camera and the shotgun, and it happens. And also some other behaviors we may witness out here. And he told me that, I snapped. I'm like, I got to see this no matter what. So,
yeah, you know, it really is, you call it the last dance. It's their last, you know, little bit before they hit the last flight to the nesting grounds. And I mean, these geese are literally putting on a pound or two probably before they make this, because I mean, when you clean these birds, there's an inch of fat on them. And that's just something you don't really see in the States during that migration, because, you know, they're strenuous, they're, you know, having to move and they're migrating every day, and, you know, weather's holding them back. And, you know, once they get up here, the weather is very timid. It's very mild. So that's another reason why you get these slow afternoon and slow morning flights, which make for a good hunt. You know, if 10,000 geese are in the field and they come out in one or two flocks, you know, that can be a real short hunt. But with like the weather that this time of year provides, you know, 60 to, I mean, it was 86 degrees 5-6 days ago. And, you know, that's abnormally not your best snow goose hunting weather. But up here, it's beautiful because the flight's long. You know, they come in those little groups of 5, 10. And, you know, it makes for a great hunt when you can just focus on those little groups. And shooters actually do a lot better shooting on those small groups because they don't get overwhelmed with all the geese coming in at once, you know. And as soon as that first shot goes off, those big flocks, you know, are crossing over, going left, right, up, down.
Which brings up a point. You can't use – there is a limit here, even during the conservation season. It's 50 geese. You can't kill, you know, 400 in a day. It's 50 per person. And – more even important to the point, there are no extended magazine tubes unless you're Mr. Mikulek himself. You only get 3 shots. So, you know, having a giant flock land on top of you, it's a visually spectacular, take your breath away. It's much better. And Jared could tell you why cameramen like the small groups.
Yes, yes. It's so much easier to focus on a 4-pack versus a 400. Whenever they're coming in. So whenever you're focusing on the small numbers as they're coming into the decoys and getting on top of you, that's so much easier because everybody's focusing on those birds to be killed.
Yep.
He doesn't have to guess which
ones. And I don't have to guess which ones are falling out of the sky.
Yep. Real cut and dry.
Well, Jordan, you know, the lower hunting pressure, a lot of people think you're crazy for snow goose hunting up here this time of year, because you're hunting now 10 months of the year or something.
Yep.
But the courtship thing.
Yep. You know, that's something you'll see is, you know, this time of the year, they are focused on breeding and, you know, putting on that weight to make that jump to those nesting grounds. And it's really common for us to see groups of 2 or 3, you know, doing the courtship flight, chasing each other around. And, you know, it gets everybody excited in the blind. You think they're about to decoy and then they'll veer off and go off for a couple hundred yards. And then eventually they do the same thing. And we've had flocks do that like 5-10 times around us and then just buzz off, you know.
That's so crazy because that's like hunting big old bucks in a rut.
Yeah. Yeah. You could call this the snow goose rut. It pretty much is.
This is.
Yeah. I don't know who could take credit for that, but yesterday, I think it was Jared said that. Yeah. I talked about how they get preoccupied. And Jared said there's a point where they snap because these are 20 to 25 year old birds, you know, 5 times older than a mature whitetail buck. They reach a point though in the spring. He goes, where do they snap? He goes, and I'm, what do you mean? He goes, they just kind of get stupid. And these birds that are unkillable and famous for circling and circling and circling and never finishing, just do it. And on the deck, they come in for this old bird dog. It gives you a heart attack to see snow geese just cup right in, drop their feet like early season mallards and roll right into the decoys. Why did they get into the smaller groups though? Is that part of the courtship breeding pre-migration?
Yeah. And you know, like up here too, like a lot of the flyways kind of intertwine here. You kind of get the Western flyway here and the Central flyway here. So birds might separate and join together because they kind of are going on different paths. Like the band we shot, you know, 5 days ago was from Alaska. So, you know, that's probably part of that Western flyway. So we kind of get, you know, both flyways right here. And, you know, that's kind of where you see some separation. You know, some of these flocks in that Western flyway are primarily all white, you know, very little blues. You don't see as many blues shot on the West Coast. And then, so you'll see a feed out here and they'll be all white, like a few blues. And then you go down the road 5 miles and then you'll see one that's covered in blues, you know, so you can kind of tell it's kind of a mix of two migrations right here. So it's a pretty unique spot.
Oh, wow. Jared was an old whitetail guide for a while. So he really perked up when he started talking about the breeding season. And
the rut. No goose rut is what I'm calling it.
Yeah.
Well, how cool.
It's a good way to put it.
We're also getting, Jordan, another aspect of that is when the weather's mild and the birds are really behaving like they're supposed to. Jordan was sending me these videos of him with the 100 bird limits, just one other shooter, and wearing his little surf shoes and socks and his legs splattered with blood, walking back to the blind. Very cool.
Yeah, it's hard to put pants on some days when it's 86 degrees, and then it backfires on you on those big hunts because every goose you go grab, it's dripping blood on you. By the end of it, you know, you can't even go into a public store or a restaurant or a grocery store because you honestly look like you committed a crime.
You're a slasher film.
Yeah.
Slasher film. He keeps one layout blind. We got to talk about that too, the A-frame versus layouts thing.
Yeah.
And that re-transition that has come back. He keeps a layout blind, though, buried in the brush to throw the birds in. And, you don't want to necessarily be the one to accidentally jump in that blind when it's empty.
Yeah.
That's one thing I did notice is that some people, whenever they are hunting, that they'll take the kill and they'll set them out as decoys. Mm-hmm. Why don't you do that?
Because primarily as we're shooting up here, we shoot some juvenile geese, some young geese, but we're primarily shooting these adult geese. These geese are old.
So they'll pick you out.
Yeah. You want to eliminate any and all chances of something that might mess them up, like parking the truck and trailer too close, you know, leaving maybe a bird fell and knocked a decoy over on its side and you're wondering why they were doing it really well and all of a sudden they're not, and you kind of go walk out there and you can find just that one random thing, a blue goose decoy tipped over on its side, and you put that back on and all of a sudden here it shows back on. And you know, they find those little things, and you know, they will expose you for every little thing. So we try to hide all the dead ones we can in, you know, an extra layout blind. Sometimes we bring two if there's, you know, a certain number of hunters, just because we'll end up stuck throwing them in our own blinds if we don't have those. And then everybody's going to come out bloody mess like I was the other day.
Well, parking that truck 1.3 miles is pretty far.
Yeah,
1.1.
Back it up, guys. So Jordan may look pretty laid back, but he's actually really anal because he's very detail oriented. Because you can tell a lot about a goose guy from where he parks his rig, right? It's kind of a tell, or at least how late in the season it is. But me and Jared,
you can tell an Alberta guy by how far he parks his truck away. Everybody I've hunted with up there, you know, it's good for exercise though. You know, you lay in a layout blind all day, need a little exercise, so you get to hike about 2 miles over them hills and get the truck.
The key tells if the guy gets out of the truck. But me and Jared are laying there and we're like, and the birds are starting to work. I actually shot a couple. I missed the two that landed in the spread. I didn't see them, but I shoot these two overhead, and Jordan's later yelling at me for letting the two in the spread go. But the point of the story is it took him forever to get back to us. And Jared said, I see a little black dot out there on the prairie. And I go, and I'm looking at the near, he goes, I think it's near those trees. And he was talking about trees on the horizon. They were so far away that when Jordan came back, I said, Jordan, how far away do you think you park? He goes, that's got to be a half mile. And he's a big game hunter and a good one.
I said 0.94.
He said 0.94 after I said 0.95. I said, that's got to be a mile. And then Jared said 1.3 or something. And it was like 1.1 or
1.1.
Something.
It took me to walk
1.1 miles. He did it in about 5 minutes.
That's with the hills. That's not a straight shot. Straight shot would have been just shy of 1 mile.
But it was no exaggeration.
I think that's why they limit the number of outfitters in any one area up there. Otherwise, they start parking their truck over where the other guy's trying to
park. Yeah, across.
And you still can't even tell where they're hunting, right? Just nuts. So fun. But we've gotten we run into some he was sending me these photos of him killing 100 in what, 20 minutes? No, an hour or two with his buddy with 20 gauges. He began to think 12 gauges are barbaric, you know, even though he's a big, strong former linebacker. But, you know, he didn't experience the writer, editor, TV crew luck. When we came, we brought mosquitoes. And
rain clouds.
We brought rain.
First rain he'd seen, and I don't know how long. We would literally have sunshine all around for miles, 360 degrees, and a big dark cloud would come over our heads. And we'd have 14-mile-an-hour southeast winds predicted, and we get dead calm and mosquitoes hovering overhead, 5 feet overhead.
And rain.
And just we have to really – we killed 3 or 4 dozen birds the first season, but it was not like it was supposed to be. They weren't finishing like they were supposed to. I finally had to yell at him to let me shoot some because he's so used to them landing right in the decoys. So he's experienced, you know, TV and writer hunting a little bit. But we also got to test out some decoys. We can't get too specific, but Mojo's coming out with an exciting prototype. I'm not for sure. No winner coming to market or if they are for sure yet, but we're testing some really interesting stuff. We can tell you that they're compact, that they're motion decoys. You could fit a whole lot of them in a backpack. And that Jordan, while we haven't had, because of the tough hunting and the switching winds, we haven't had a clear, perfect demonstration of their lethality yet. He's come to Jordan guides for months in Arkansas in the circus down there for snow geese. And he's come to think that they will have some efficiency down there in some application. And I'll let you guys take it from there. And then Terry can tell us a little bit about how the thing came to be.
Yeah. Yeah, no, definitely. When, you know, from what I've seen, you know, stuff that's realistic in motion, you know, some stuff does not look realistic. You know, what I've seen so far is it's very realistic as far as snow geese. You know, I don't know how much we want to touch base on that, but I will say that, you know, I see a very good future in it. It creates that motion that you see when you drive by and it looks like birds are moving. And I feel like it's a very beneficial product and tool, if you will, for those no wind days when, you know, you've got 500 or, you know, some guys have 1500 full bodies out and they're all just statues. Mm. So this is something that I think will be a problem solver for those days.
And particularly you thought it might be good in the lower 48, right?
Oh, definitely. And I feel like especially, you know, those younger birds, those juvenile birds are going to eat it up. You know, that's something they haven't seen. And something new like that is something you need to use because they do get used to certain things, you know, like, you know, for example, some ducks in the States don't decoy to the spinning decoys like they do up here because, you know, sometimes they see it a lot, you know, a lot more hunters down there. So, you know, for snow geese is the same thing in the States. There's a million people doing it now. And, you know, when I first started out, no one was doing it. So you could throw those random things out there and it seemed like it worked. And then all of a sudden it just doesn't work 1 year.
And then everyone thought they had to have 10,000 decoys. But that's changed with
silhouettes,
right?
Yep. Yeah. No, silhouettes and, you know, sock decoys have made it, especially silhouettes have made it really, you know, either affordable or, you know, micro spreads. You can put that in a pickup truck. So there's definitely a lot more pressure these days because of stuff like that.
Well, cool. Let's talk to Mr. Demlin. Tell us what you'll tell us, Terry, because from what we've seen, we've had birds land right on them. I'll put it at that. When we removed them, we were flaring birds. We blamed it on the possibility that the decoy was moving too much or something. And when we removed them, the birds flared even worse. That was during the cloudy no-wind situation when nothing will work and we all know it. So we don't have a real conclusion, but tell us a little bit about it. Tell us what you will, Mr. Demlin.
I'll be glad to. You know, in the world of waterfowling, developing a motion goose decoy has always been the challenge. You know, a lot of people worked on it. You know, they come out with flappers and spinners, and I don't mean wing spinners, I mean decoy body spinners and all kind of different things, and nothing has ever proved to be real successful. Some years ago, I started working on decoys for ducks where the decoy body itself didn't move. And that led me to the Flock of Flicker, which has been an incredibly successful product. And, you know, on the Flock of Flickers, it's a little bitty blade, but it's not in a decoy body. It's just you scatter it amongst your decoys. And what we learned by experimenting with that was the body of the bird, your decoy body of the bird itself does not need to move. If you got a number of them out there, you know, typical spread, and you just put some realistic tight movement amongst that spread, the birds don't seem to pick up on that. You know, they don't notice that the goose decoy itself is not moving or the duck decoy itself is not moving. And so we kind of been carrying that concept a little further along. Now, if you get if you get past geese in general and get to snow goose, they're probably the hardest thing to figure out, you know, some kind of motion that you can put into your spread. And so this little, you know, this little device here, you know, it's just a little motion type deal that you scatter amongst your decoy spread. And, you know, when we're working on a new decoy of some kind, the first thing we want to determine is that the decoy is not going to scare the birds, you know, and if it'll scare the birds, then it's basically a no go. Now, you know, we've been in the spinning wing duck decoy business, you know, since the get go. And, you know, that was one thing that it did. And I can hear people right now saying, well, they'll scare a duck, but, you know, they really won't. The ducks learn that they're a danger to them, and they learn to shy away from them. But that's a totally different concept than actually scaring the birds. You know, they've just learned that's not necessarily a safe place to land, and that's good. You know, if animals don't catch on to what we do, I guess we would eventually annihilate it. Especially, you know, people like you three, y'all would annihilate the whole population if we didn't have to constantly change things and they couldn't constantly check on to them. So that's basically what we've done here. We've developed a little device that it doesn't scare. Doesn't scare birds. We got about 250 of those things right now scattered, you know, from Louisiana, Arkansas, all the way up this way. And we're about to the time where we start getting feedback on them, you know. But one thing people tell me is they don't scare the birds. So that's rule number one you got to make. So, you know, past that, you want to make it as attractive to the birds as you can. By attractive, I don't mean pretty. I mean it attracts them, you know, to them. And the idea there is just to, you know, just to add some motion. There are some products on the market today that are wind-driven products that, from what I know about, we don't make one, but from what I know about them, they will attract snow geese if you got enough wind. If you don't have enough wind, they're no good at all. So, ours is battery-operated, which most everything we make is battery-operated. It'll run for, I don't even know how long, you know, probably 3 or 4 or 5 hunts on 4 AA batteries. So, you know, that's certainly economical from a battery point of view. But we've played around with, you know, a lot of those things, after the flock of flicker concept came out, you know. But if you try to make a goose decoy, a motion decoy, you know, you're starting out with such a expensive item to begin with, a goose decoy, you know, and the decoy itself, money wise, would overpower the motion part of it. And so, you know, most of those things that I've seen is brought to the market, you know, they upwards of $200 up to $300. So, you know, it'd be pretty hard to own enough of them, you know, to be able to really make your decoy spread look like it was live and was moving around. And also, you know, they're not that portable. So, you know, that was kind of the rules that we used to establish this little decoy. It's effective. It's economical. It's portable. You know, you could have a backpack with, I know you put 30 of them in a backpack because we've done it before. We're not a very big backpack too. So you scatter 30 of them around through a decoy spread, and the motion that it's got, it's certainly going to make that decoy spread look, you know, look lifelike. It's looking like it's moving around. Now, you know how all waterfowl is, except for early season Alberta mallards, which are pretty easy when I've been up there, and I've been up there a lot of times, you know. You know, waterfowl just tough. They different every day. They seem to have a different thought process every day, you know. They're certainly attracted or not attracted or, you know, shy off from different things every day. So it's hard to get a decoy that, you know, will accomplish all that. And after several years of work, you know, this is what we've been able to come up with.
Well, I would like to just ask, you know, this kind of all begs a question, you know, what's wrong with you, Terry?
I'm weird.
You're one of the most successful decoy companies in history, if not the. And you could just relax and go hunt and sit in the jacuzzi and pat yourself on the back all day. That's what I would do, of course, if that jacuzzi was close enough to cast into my private bass pond. But what drives you to keep figuring out a way to harass all these poor innocent animals out there that we love to chase around? What is it that makes you wake up at like 2 a.m. in a cold sweat? Just snow geese. No one can kill snow geese. And
I got to fix that. What about the children who want to hunt in the future? I'm not going to be here forever. I got to help them out. Now, what makes you tick, man? I don't know if I've encouraged you enough on this important subject.
It's in the genes. I hunted with a guy in Africa one time, and I adopted his favorite saying, and it was, a day without blood is like a day without sunshine.
Oh, wow. So, I don't think I'll put that in a...
You know, I don't know. You know, I've been hunting since I was, basically a baby or something like that. If you hunt some, you know, you want to get better at it. You know, you want to find tools that help you to be more successful. I remember, Skip, one time years ago, you asked me, you said, where you come up with all these ideas at? And I said, I don't know. I'll wake up in the night and they kind of come to me. And you looked at me kind of funny. You said, really? I said, no, I'm telling you the truth. You know, you think about something. And I don't get into that deep sleep that allows you to dream. So it's pretty rare for me to have a dream. It's common for me to wake up all during the night. I asked Jared, he stayed in hotel rooms with me, or whatever. And so I guess you just, when you focus on something, that something could come back to a dream. I know that it be disjointed pretty bad, but it'd come into a dream. But I guess the same thing happens to me. I get to thinking about that. You know, I get a lot of people ask me, why don't you make goose motion decoys? Well, I would if I could get one at work, you know, like we would like for it to work, you know. So you're just always kind of thinking about that. And so you're thinking about it, different thoughts come through. And fortunately, after a certain period of time, hopefully a correct one will come through. But I used to have a friend, he died a couple of years ago. He was very, very rich. And he helped invent a computer chip. He was an electrical engineer. He lived in Silicon Valley, California at the time. He had a favorite saying I liked. He said, you know, I've jumped over a lot of good ideas trying to get to a bad one. And that's basically about how, you know, product development goes. You know, usually, you know, after you go through all the renditions of it, the obvious answer was right there in front of you, but you couldn't see it. So you just have to stay after it. And I don't know. I have a passion for doing that. I have a passion for, you know, inventing things that work. And I've invented a lot of things that didn't work, but fortunately we hit one every now and then that does. I think we got it. I think we got one in this one, if it proves, but you know, we don't like to develop a product and just put it on the market. And we typically do what we're doing right here. You know, we'll come up with a product. We'll make so many prototypes. We'll get them in the hands of, you know, people like Jordan that know what they're doing and is out there every day. And if they're successful, we'll bring them out. If they're not, you know, it goes over in the corner and we'll move on to something else.
So you dream, you don't have dream sleep. So you just dream of hunting is what you didn't quite say there, but we're putting words in your mouth. You wake up, you have waking dreams of hunting. I love it. Well, you were here to improve the quality of the hunting experience for all of us, as you have actually millions of people. If we include dove hunters over the year.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's really a cool insight.
Mojo Dove, I think, is everywhere.
Uh-huh.
In bulk.
I'm not allowed to say whether or not they outsell the duck decoys or not, so I'm not even going to ask that question.
It's the Dove decoy is our number one selling individual product. Now, we only have, you know, two motion Dove decoys, and we got a lot of duck decoys. So if you added all the duck decoys up, it would get to be more of a contest, and I haven't done that in the last few years, but I still expect that Dove decoy, the Voodoo, the one that's been around for a long time, it would always be our number one selling product.
Mm. And I'm not ever supposed to, and I would never do that to Terry to mention that they sometimes work to fill out your teal decoy spread, so I wouldn't do that.
Yeah, we've had to discuss that, and you know, people tell me all the time, you know, about, you know, duck hunting with a Dove decoy, and I look at them as serious as I can. You know, I'm a little poker face anyway, so I look at them as serious as I can. I said, you know, that's illegal. I have never had one person say, oh, that couldn't be illegal. You know, they'll come around to it in a few minutes, but they don't get it to begin with. So I have to tell them, no, I'm just kidding with you. It's not illegal, but it ought to be. If I could get that law passed, I would.
Oh, well, your teal decoys work just fine. Yeah. We're going to touch on one more important subject about this we're experimenting with during the snow goose rut here. You guys were in on it when you know, layout blinds really first came massively into vogue in the late 90s, early 2000s, and then really took over waterfowl hunting when we figured out how to shoot birds from the middle of an open, empty field where they always felt so safe from us slinking around the ditches and the fence rows and the edges. And then over the next 15 years, layouts became so common that you couldn't hide them enough. You couldn't make zero shadow enough that the geese, they began to shy away from the and middle of all fields where they had come to learn to experience. Two or three generations of geese at that point had come to learn to experience danger. And Jordan, you could talk a little bit about this now, the how the A-frame popularity that never really quit in Canada came raging back until you started seeing in Arkansas as well. Just talk about that a little bit, why that you think the A-frames came back and why you now think, based on what you've seen. I was surprised when we got here and you were telling us we're going to bury in layouts or near edges again, and that they were in fact becoming shy from the A-frame. So
yeah, you know, I think it's just kind of they adjust, you know. I think they're seeing the same thing so much, and you know, the A-frame off the edge or off, you know, grass islands, rock piles, you know, or even in the middle has kind of became a real common thing. You know, they kind of have never, they've been doing that up here in Alberta forever, as far as I remember coming up here, but in the States, it blew up, I would say, in like that 2018, 19, you really started to see it really show up and everybody's starting to do it. Guys that you typically never see doing it were doing it. And, you know, it's impacted how they approach, you know, spreads now. I feel like they see that bush blind now and they know that's a bush of hunters. You know, they don't see it as a hide typically like they do anymore. So I think guys are kind of transitioning back into the, like we are trying to go back into making your hide as good as it can be. And, you know, A-frames can hide good in that stuff. That's the equal or greater height as it, you know, the grass or, you know, whatever it may be, tree line helps hide those. But, you know, if it's flat and, you know, it's tough to hide those things, you know, and it's a risk, you know, it either works or it doesn't, you know, layouts are a little more consistent in certain scenarios. And, you know, like where we hunt these fence lines and, you know, these slough bottoms, you know, those are as good as a hide can get. And I think a reason too, more people went to A-frames is, you know, advancement in farming, you know, the wheat stubble, it feels like it's getting shorter and shorter every year, you know, because, you know, they don't waste as much anymore. You know, they're way more efficient with cutting that, you know, that stubble and, you know, that's, you know, eliminating those layout hides. So you really kind of got to, you know, find something else to do to replace that.
Well, the geese are
responding. You know, Skip, I'm down here in Louisiana. I don't get to duck hunt in Louisiana as much as I used to because I stay on the road so much, but you know, we're about the bottom end of the flyway. If you take Mexico and Nicaragua and those places out of it, we're about the bottom end of the flyway. So they've been shot by everybody, called by everybody, decoyed by everybody by the time we get them. And there's one thing that we've been saying for probably 10 years is that a mallard duck knows what a duck blind looks like. You know, it's got straight lines. It doesn't matter if it's a pit blind, it doesn't matter if it's an A-frame, permanent. You know, they build a lot of blinds on stilts here, big old blinds. And actually, some of those big blinds that you think would be the worst will now work the best because they don't look like the typical duck blind. Back when I was hooked up with Mike Morgan and Jim Jones, and we were producing TV shows, the most popular one of which was Hunting Across America. Then Jim Jones came up with this concept. I don't know who he got it from, that if you made a duck blind big enough where it didn't look like a duck blind, it worked fine. And so we bought a pontoon boat and rigged it all up, actually put a lean-to on the back of it. We had some 17-foot flat bottoms that we were using on this particular lake where we had this thing, and we could run a 17-foot flat bottom in there. And this thing was huge. And gadwalls would come up there and land right by it. They didn't perceive it to be a duck blind.
Sit up on top with a Mai Tai cocktail and a lawn chair and your favorite golf shirt in a 410 and just have at them, huh?
Pretty much, yeah.
I accept this invitation.
I don't know what happened to that. You know, Mike and Jim both died since then. I don't know what happened to that pontoon boat, but I wish I did. I'd go get it and put it in my duck field. But the first The first show we were going to film out of it, we didn't do this, or at least I wasn't there when it did. We was going to film with tuxedos on. That's probably why I wasn't there. I didn't want a tuxedo. But, you know, we're just going to show, you know, how easy it was, you know, VIP hunting.
I remember some of those first guys, Jared, do you remember that, that were using fans on decoys back when reaping was brand new and even murderously effective? They were guys were wearing.
Yeah, they were in suits or, you know, Amish clothing and whatever else.
Or the Beastie Boys Sabotage outfit. Well, there you go, Jordan. That's your missing part of your otherwise incredible program up here. You know, you're making all these, let's dig out all these fancy layout lines. You could probably put a hot tub in the middle of the field. They would not perceive it as a threat.
Yep.
We have a much more pleasant hunting experience.
Yep. Bury the generator and we can sit in the warm water like late October.
That's perfect.
Make it a pothole in a field.
I'm trying to be funny here with marginal success, but I actually had this moment. I was standing on the back deck of this beautiful lodge of his yesterday morning, and these geese kept flying. And these same geese we hunt, this is open country, wild fields here surrounding the place. They were flying over my head 30 yards in shotgun range while I'm standing there drinking my coffee. And I thought, yeah, we can't get these snow geese to come closer to 30 yards or come within 30 yards. And if I was standing out in the middle of that field, these geese wouldn't be flying this close to me. But because I'm in this, you know, 5,000 square foot house lodge / blind, they were completely oblivious. It's kind of interesting, huh?
Yeah, it's a good flyway right here.
They got a pea-sized brain and they're smarter than you think, you know? Well, Terry, I think we were talking earlier about possibly what, late July? When can folks find out more specifics on, because we're going to go find out more specifics this evening here in just a little bit. We got to run. We got to get back to the field and put out a couple hundred David Smith decoys, full bodies, and see if we can scare some more geese. But when do you think we can find out the specifics if you decide to go to market with this decoy?
Well, you know, we have this decoy fully developed. We have the tooling and the molding and everything done. I could start making them tomorrow if I wanted to, but we've just been watching to see. Like I say, we'd like to prove that it's a useful product. We don't like to put a product on the market that's not useful, it's marginal. We don't want the general public to test them by having to buy one and then find out, you know, they don't work. That's just not how we work. So, you know, we're getting to the point now to where we need to decide, okay, is it a go or a no-go? And if it is, what would happen? We would have a limited supply on the market this fall. And the reason it would be limited would not be because we can't make enough of them. We can do that, no problem at all. It's that, you know, we basically missed the selling season, you know, for a lot of the big box type stores, you know, and they picked their fall products up way before now. So we would probably manufacture a limited run, and they would be available in the places that can offer a product with limited time like this. So yeah, it would probably, if it a limited supply will be available this fall if it's a go. If it's not a go, you'll never see or hear from it again. So they would be available this coming fall.
Oh, cool.
certainly by snow goose conservation season.
Right. And we got the big, we get the giant wildfowl August gear issue coming out here, and it's re-released, of course, in late fall, biggest magazine in the industry. And we have a wildfowl big goose issue coming out in September. Hopefully we can give the readers a lot more detail on it by then. Meanwhile, what we can do, fellas, is get out and see how it works some more here in about an hour and a half.
Yes.
You guys have any more questions? You want any more observations on the snow goose?
Yeah, if you're going to take this idea and toss it away, toss it my direction, because I could use it regardless.
You keep those that Skip and Jared brought up there too, you know, and keep using them. And how much longer will you hunt?
I'm actually going to hunt tomorrow, and then I'm actually heading to bear camp. So I'm going to Northern Alberta.
Said, yeah. Yeah, I got you. Yeah.
Keep them
anyway, and you'll have them for start of season next year. Yeah.
Yeah, it won't hurt my feelings if nobody else has what I got either. So
talk a little bit about how late you have hunted this crazy snow goose season that is so much later than anyone's hunting. Jordan promised me it was. I said I don't want to book a flight to Canada just for snow geese because they are the most difficult thing to pin down on earth. And he goes, well, of all snow goose hunting, he said, this is the absolutely most predictable, your best shot at having a consistent experience in the snow goose world, because they have to stop here before they quote unquote jump the trees. How late have you done it, Jordan?
So I've shot them here until May 27th, and that was that would have been 2018 spring. Obviously COVID, we didn't get to come up that spring, but I've seen them here until about May 20th, you know, end of May. And I, when I,
what's your season? What's your season then?
I think it goes till, I think June, middle of June or June 1st. I'd have to double check. I think there's two different areas. So one area goes later than the other, but yeah, you can, I mean, it's summertime when you're shooting these things in 70, 80 degrees and, you know, anywhere else, like in the States, if it warms up like that during the spring, I mean, those geese are long gone. I mean, they'll go from Arkansas to northern Missouri just like that. And, you know, up here, it doesn't faze them because they know that they're at that last step, that last journey. So,
me and Jared and Nate were up there one time in late August playing with some decoys before the season started. And there wasn't enough nighttime to recharge your batteries. You know, you got to take two sets of batteries up there. And you couldn't get in from the night hunt till it's time to leave to go on the morning hunt. It kind of reminded me of when I used to bear hunt in Alaska in May a lot. You know, you couldn't hunt daylight and dark both. You know, you couldn't hunt the first two hours.
Me and Jared were like so relieved that we're doing mostly evening hunts so far, because you need to be out of bed at 3 o'clock in the morning to make the 4:30 daylight. Sunrise is at 5, and you we're getting back from these hunts at 10:30, 11 o'clock.
Yeah, we're leaving the field at 10.
Yeah, you can, as of right now, you can shoot at, like, I think 4:59 right now is shoot time. And for the morning, and then at night it's like 9:34. So, yeah, they're long days this time.
Yeah, when we were up there, Jared, we'd get in about 11 o'clock at night and leave at 3 o'clock in the morning. That wasn't enough time to charge the batteries, you know, the camera batteries and the decoy batteries and our sleep.
Well, on that note, I'm going to put you on the spot, Jordan. Why not? Just have a go at telling folks, you're a veteran of the Arkansas Snow Goose Wars that we all have dreamed of, and some of us have been lucky enough to go in to the peak season in Missouri and Arkansas and Louisiana. And you're a veteran of those. You do it every year for 50 days, I think you said. And what are folks who put all their chips in that barrel? What are they missing out on if they don't come try this late season snow goose rut experience?
You know, so I like to say Arkansas is kind of a spray and pray, right? You know, you're getting those big flocks in, you're not aiming as much. You know, we instruct the clients and whoever's hunting to empty their gun into the thickest part of the flock, right? And up here, it's more sporty. You're shooting little groups, you know what I mean? And it's 2 hours, where in Arkansas, it might be a 10, 15 minute, you know, flight, and it's over like that because they come in those huge wads. But up here, you know, I've had shoots where it goes on for 3 hours because they're only coming in pairs, four, three. So it's different. And they get off the roost in Arkansas and they go a mile high and then go to the field. Here they are almost hitting the trees on their way to the field. They're so low. So it's a totally different bird, in my opinion, when they get up here. It's a totally different bird.
You know, you got to see it to believe it. Well, so everyone in the world is thinking about bass fishing and turkey hunting winding down. We're going to go put out a bunch of decoys, guys, and have at it. Thank you, Mr. Denman. Thank you, Jared Chestnut and Jordan Maul. Look up Hidden Prairie Outfitters on Facebook and Instagram. Stay on top of Mojo Outdoors to see what they got going on at all times. And for heaven's sakes, follow them on Instagram. You'll enjoy the heck out of that if you haven't been. And check out wildfowlmag.com for more great content. And stay tuned this early fall for more on this decoy and a little bit more on how it works out for us the rest of this awesome trip in Alberta. And above all, remember what I learned today. Don't jump over good ideas to get to a bad one. Thanks for listening, guys. Until next time, y'all have a good one.
Thanks, guys.